For joining us here today. It's been an eventful period, and it's not been so easy getting in and out of the club, but obvious reasons out there, but which we'll address in the discussion today. But good to see such a good turnout. I just want to start by paying a very quick, brief tribute to one of our longest-serving members, Vijay Kulkarni, a stalwart of the board and of numerous committees down the years, who sadly passed away last week. We will provide further information about a club event in his honour in due course. Just a quick note on mobile phones. Please do turn them off or switch to silent. That said, we do welcome people live tweeting their thoughts and comments during the event on your Twitter feed or on other social media. If you would like, our hashtag is FCCHK, if you'd like to mention that. So now to today's talk. In the past couple of days, we've seen the police start to dismantle some of the barricades out there that have paralyzed parts of the city for 3 weeks now. But they cannot remove the broader pressures for change that lie behind the Occupy and Students Reform pressures concerning political reform, as well as demands for a fairer distribution of opportunity for a generation, a young generation today that fears the future is being lost to it. Those pressures will ultimately require a political solution from the likes of our guests today. They are two of Hong Kong's best-known politicians, veterans of countless battles waged on either side of the pro-democracy front lines. In fact, they hail from the same township in Guangdong province, going back a little while, but clearly their paths have diverged since then. They don't require much more by the way of introduction, so I'm delighted to welcome Regina Ip, chairwoman of the New People's Party, and Emily Lau, chairwoman of the Democratic Party. Just a quick word on the format today. Regina and Emily will speak for about 5 minutes each to set out their competing appraisals of recent events, and that will leave us hopefully plenty of time for Q&As from the floor, which we'll get to before we wrap up about 2 o'clock. Okay? So without further ado, can I please welcome Regina to the
First of all, thank you, Mr. President, Jitendra of FCC. Thank you to FCC for having me back. I think the last time I was here as a speaker was 2007, so it's been some time, you know. And I also wish to thank the FCC for today's motion. Is it worth shutting down the city to achieve universal suffrage, and what's the future of Hong Kong? I think the topic is well chosen. Now, first of all, I think that the Occupy Central protests, they are not helping us move toward universal suffrage. Because the work on getting Hong Kong to universal suffrage-based chief executive elections in 2017 is being held up by these protests. Stage two of the consultation, during which we are supposed to discuss the details about the composition of the nominating committee and how members of the nominating committee are to vote, one person two votes or one person three votes, or by approval vote, or by single transferable vote, and by secret ballot or otherwise, all these details, all these detailed discussions cannot now take place because of the street protests. The chief secretary has announced that she is deferring stage two of the consultation. We must bear in mind, although the NPCSC decision of August was a disappointment to many who want a broader range of choices in choosing the CE candidate in 2017, it was a framework decision, after all, a framework decision. As mainland officials have stressed time and again, the bulk of the work, you know, chief executive election by universal suffrage has to be implemented by local legislation enacted by the legislature. The nominating committee, contrary to a lot of Western misunderstanding, is not some sort of a Republican Guard Council superimposed by Beijing against Hong Kong people's will. All the nominating committee members will be elected by Hong Kong people, some by organizations, some by individuals coming from, for example, the 10 professions, including many highly progressive, liberal-minded members. So the bulk of the work will be done in Hong Kong. And the Hong Kong legislature, people like Emily and me, we have a big part to play in making universal suffrage possible. The street protests, the protesters, I met several, and I understand their grievances and their anger. I think their aspirations, their grievances, the anger, they're all legitimate. But the way they go about it is no doubt unlawful. And what we have seen, particularly from latest events, you know, people trying to, civilian groups trying to dismantle the barricades, and then the protesters fortifying the barricades with bamboo poles and concrete, we are beginning to see a breakdown of law and order. The lawlessness that is surfacing is disturbing. This is not what Hong Kong is famous for. After all, democracy, a proper functioning democracy, must be based on constitutional requirements, must be based on rational discussions, as in many successful democratic countries. If we look at UK, the current democratic system is not born overnight, it's the evolution over centuries. Look at the US, their constitution was framed after many, many long hours of discussions, painstaking discussions at constitutional conventions. That's what we need in Hong Kong, rational dialogue. Taking the debate back to LegCo, enabling all members of our society to have a voice in putting forward their views on how the nominating committee will be set up and who has the votes, and so on and so forth. So the street protests are not helping us move toward universal suffrage. On the other hand, they are leading to a breakdown of law and order, of considerable concern to the business community, to investors, to political risk consultancies, who are watching not only how the government would resolve the deep-rooted social, political, and economic problems, but also watching the government's performance in resolving the current crisis. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
President Joshi, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity here this afternoon to brief you on the latest situation from my party's point of view and also from many Hong Kong people's point of view. I just came from the demonstration area and I just came from Bloomberg, and I'm very happy that Bloomberg decided to do an extended coverage of Hong Kong, telling the whole world what's going on. As we speak, there's confrontation outside the Cheung Kong Centre, but I hope there will not be violence. In the last 10 days, countless foreign journalists have asked me, will there be a Tiananmen in Hong Kong? I said, no, we will not allow it. The business community will not allow it. The political community will not allow it. So I use this occasion again to tell CY Leung, who may be too afraid to come to LegCo on Thursday, and to tell Beijing, we cannot, we must not have a violent crackdown. The demonstrations, as all of you have seen, have been very peaceful and non-violent, exceedingly civilized. Just then, a foreign journalist told me, he said, aren't they just too civilized? Because for those of you hardened journalists who have been all over the world covering massacres, beheading, slaughter, you come to a little Hong Kong and you see all these peaceful demonstrators, students in uniforms, going there to do their homework, volunteers gathering waste, doing separation of waste, recycling. They say, what the hell's going on? But these people are also very determined, determined to fight for their own future and the future of the People's Republic of China. I said CY Leung may be too scared to come on Thursday, because this Thursday, tomorrow, we should have our sitting, I hope, because last week the president canceled it because some members are too frightened to enter the building. In fact, they come to the building every day, but they say there is probably no safe passage. And you know the building's being surrounded by protesters who are very peaceful. So I told the president, Jasper Zhang, I said, what you forecast 1 or 2 years ago, that if the political reform cannot be settled peacefully, Hong Kong could become ungovernable. Is that what's happening now, or almost? On Bloomberg, I told the investors all over the world that my party, that the pro-democracy movement are very keen to see Hong Kong as a business-friendly city. We welcome investors from all over the world to come here to do business, to invest. How else would my people get employment? And I say sorry to the business concerns, the people who have been affected. But just like them, just like those people, I want this whole thing to stop as soon as possible. And as the president here said, it's a political issue. Why put the police there between the protesters and the anti-protesters? As we all know, we don't want war. It's jaw. The students, the legislators, the Occupy trio, all of us have said we are eager, we are happy to engage in dialogue with the government here and with Beijing. But they turn us down. What are they trying to do? Well, we saw elements, some say triad elements, organized elements, provoking trouble with the peaceful protesters. My people are very angry. They are very concerned. They say, what's going on? Regina talk about lawlessness. Well, who created it? Who provoked it? So for those of you who are reporting on Hong Kong, I hope you will report accurately. Have you ever seen any picture of the protesters beating up the police? So anyway, my time is up, and we would welcome questions. And I again thank the FCC, because this is a full house, and I know more than 100 people are on the waiting list, and I hope you will put it online so that more people can hear what we have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll throw it open to questions from the floor. Please wait to be called upon and wait for the microphone to come to you. When you do ask your question, please identify yourself and your affiliation. I'll just exercise presidential prerogative here, if you don't mind, and kick things off by asking you both. You know, we're day by day, the events fluctuate, but the big context remains, what does Beijing want? What will Beijing accede to, and what could it possibly concede on? Do you see any sign, any indication that Beijing might draw the correct conclusions, in your view, from everything that's gone on here? Emily, do you want to start?
Okay, thank you. Well, too many people, including Regina, have said, Beijing will not wear it. No way. Well, No need to tell us that. What I want people like Regina and all of you in this room and the business and political elites to tell Beijing is not that you think Beijing will not accept any of the proposals. It's to tell them what you think Beijing should do. If you look at the peaceful protesters and you look at the demand, which is very reasonable, these people are politically so mature. You tell me they can't handle democracy? So you go and tell Beijing. Maybe you have told Beijing in the past not to give us genuine universal suffrage. But this time round, I want you to say, hey, look, these people should have democracy. It will be good for Hong Kong and good for the People's Republic of China. So that's what I think we should say, instead of just acting like a parrot. Oh, Beijing will not allow it. Forget it. If we only do what things that Beijing allow, I won't be sitting here today.
If I could pick up what Emily said earlier, she talked as though Beijing wanted a, quote, bloody crackdown in Hong Kong, you know. I'm pretty sure that's the last thing they want, or what the SAR government would want. As you, I'm sure all of you have noticed, after all the criticisms leveled at the police, unfairly so in my mind, in my view, after the use of tear smoke, the Hong Kong government has been playing soft and playing long, deploying female officials, you know, to talk to the protesters, daily briefings by police commanders. I think everybody's trying very hard to avoid physical confrontation, you know, physical clashes that would further ruin the stability and reputation of Hong Kong. Also, I disagree with Emily that the demands made by the protesters are reasonable. Far from it, they are unrealistic, totally unrealistic. For example, the demands issued by the students dictating to the chief executives to step down by a certain hour and for Beijing to repeal its decision made only a month and a half ago, that's totally unrealistic and unachievable. Can you imagine how can a country of 1.3 billion people govern if they succumb to street protests? You know, there are actually thousands of protests in mainland China all the day. China is becoming modern. It's a very open society with the use of social media, WeChat, Weibo, and all that. There are protests over all sorts of causes every day. If China handled Hong Kong in the way Emily suggested, the whole of China would become ungovernable. So these requests are totally unrealistic. And I'm glad the students have dropped these demands. And I'm all for dialogue and engagement with the students. I have been pressing them to enter into an open, televised dialogue or debate with me and members of my party, but have fallen on deaf ears. You know, I'd be happy, very happy to explain to them the constitutional realities and the legal procedures required to turn universal suffrage-based elections for the chief executive into reality, but they are not responding.
Thank you. Questions from the floor? Anna?
Anna Fenton, freelance journalist. Should we be, this is for Regina, should we be frightened of Beijing?
Why should you be frightened of Beijing?
Why not?
Why? Why in the first place? What are you frightened about? A lot of people are happy here, living here, doing business, investing. Why should people be frightened? What are your assumptions? What are your assumptions?
You're turning the question back on me.
Yeah.
I'm asking you, should we be frightened of Beijing?
I think there is no reason to be frightened. Lots of people, Hong Kongers, foreign businessmen, do business in China, mainland China and in Hong Kong. I see no reason why people should be frightened.
Good.
Thank you. Steve Vines.
My name is Steve Vines. This again is a question for Mrs. Yip. I notice that yet again, given an opportunity, you talk about law and order and the breakdown of law and order, but I haven't heard from you or any of your colleagues on your side of the fence one person standing up and saying how much you deplore the introduction of organised crime into Hong Kong's political process. It would be very nice if for once you said that unambiguously. But more than that, what is so depressing about your approach to this is you are one of the people who was a main mover for the LegCo investigation, not into the issue of what's going on, but who is behind the protesters. You seem to have such contempt for the people of Hong Kong that you cannot conceive that Hong Kong people themselves can organise this. Why is that?
Returning to your first question first, to the involvement of organised crime triads in the protest, I think Secretary for Security T.K. Lai had very emphatically said the government had no collusion with the triads. Police officers have said so emphatically. You know, when people occupy Mong Kok, which is well known for illegal activities, triad activities, you know, triad involvements bound to occur on both camps. I condemn it. If you want, I am happy to condemn it. T.K. Lai has condemned it. Police commanders have condemned it, you know. But you know what Mong Kok is like? You are old Hong Kong hands, you know. When you occupy Mong Kok and affect the business of so much, so many illegal gangs, you know, certain illegal activities are triad activities, triad involvement are bound to surface, you know. And I don't understand why people need to occupy Mong Kok and Causeway Bay when they've said Occupy Central. You know. Returning to your second question, I think it's pretty, as an observer, I don't want to cause any diplomatic incident, and I have no concrete information at this stage. As an observer based in Wan Chai, there's a lot of organized activities going on, truckloads of supplies, you know. The protesters get better food, better refreshments than the policemen, you know. And the people moving, actually stealing the Mills barriers and other government properties in Wan Chai, moving them to Canton Road, moving them to Mong Kok, large-scale organization behind the scheme, and use of advanced technology. Even after police disabled communication in Queensway on Sunday, 28 September, people were able to communicate. There's a lot of very sophisticated organization going on. I think the LegCo ought to look into that.
Any questions, please, for Emily Lau?
Thank you. I'm Aaron Back from the Wall Street Journal. Emily, Regina mentioned the second round consultation and some of the issues to be decided in terms of, excuse me, can you hear me? Some of the issues to be decided in the second round consultation in terms of the composition of the committee, how members vote. Is there any way to make that procedure within the framework handed down by Beijing democratic enough to satisfy you or people on your side of the aisle? And failing that, can you see any compromise with Beijing short of civic nomination?
Thank you. I think our views are very clear. Under the current decision by the National People's Congress Standing Committee, that means the nominating committee, the current election committee will be transformed into the nominating committee, and the four sectors will remain unchanged, and the corporate votes will also remain unchanged, and the franchise for choosing that committee is about $250,000. I don't think that the composition of all that will give anybody confidence that it would be a very fair process to nominate a candidate, plus the fact that the threshold for nomination is 51% at least, whereas on the previous occasions with the small circle election, it was 12.5%. So instead of going forward, we're going backwards. And to cap it all, Beijing said there can only be 2 to 3 candidates. So with that framework, there is no way that it can be an election that would measure up to international standards. And Beijing will immediately scream because they don't want to know about international standards.
But when they publish the white paper on one country, two systems on the 10th of June, they did it in seven languages. So how more international can you get? Well, to make it international, I am flying to the United Nations on Saturday because the Human Rights Committee will be having hearing on Thursday week. And I will tell the committee of what's going on because the committee has urged Hong Kong to have real universal suffrage for many years. So I used the occasion to tell the Human Rights Committee what's going on. And because of that, my party has decided to cancel our 20th anniversary dinner on Friday week. Of course, 20th anniversary is important, but there are far more important things to do. So to answer your question, no, the current framework will not work. But I have said many times, I accept that the electoral method for choosing the CE in 2017 must comply with the basic law, comply with the National People's Congress Standing Committee decision in 2012, and also comply with international standards. So what are international standards? It's not that mysterious or complicated. It means an electoral system which will not contain any unreasonable limitations and will give the voters a genuine choice. And I want to remind the British Prime Minister, Cameron, it's genuine choice, it's not proper choice. And the British, having run Hong Kong for 1.5 centuries, have a duty, politically and morally, to speak out and use the correct language. Thank you, Mr. President.
Could I respond to that question as well, you know?
Briefly.
Because actually, although the NPC decision says the numbers represented on the nominating committee and the proportion of the four categories remain unchanged, there is room for discussion of how to delimit the 38 subsectors within the nominating committee and how many votes different organizations will have. And if there are going to be 2 to 3 candidates, each member of the nominating committee will have 2 to 3 votes. And if a candidate works hard, even from the Democratic camp, you cannot rule out the possibility of somebody like Alan Seaman giving 1 vote to a Democrat and 2 votes to a pro-establishment candidate. So the opportunity is there. And I don't think Emily should rule out her chances or jump to a conclusion at this stage.
Thank you. I'm going to take a question from the table now. Tara, and then Doug, and then Keith.
Thanks very much. Regina Ip, I'd like to ask if, beyond the constructs of a potential electoral system, is the government not going to do something, and does it not realize it, that it has a disaffected younger generation in Hong Kong? Beyond the political will, these protests have shown that there's a whole generation that's wishing for an identity and some sort of opportunity in the future. What's the government going to do about it?
I agree with you entirely. Life is not just about politics. It's about giving young people hope and upward mobility. But this cannot be done through street protests. The demonstrators need to allow government to get back to work and allow the legislature to get back to work, work out the details regarding how to set up the nominating committee, how they will vote, you know. And allow universal suffrage to take place. And the filibustering will not help. I have legislative colleagues threatening filibustering. That's not helping to resolve the young people's problems.
Doug.
Hi, Douglas Wong, former governor, journalist for Bloomberg. Ms. Lau, I wonder whether you could, you took a question just now about the next stage, and Ms. Yip earlier was saying that the protests have delayed the next stage of the consultation on suffrage, and I'm just wondering whether what your thoughts on whether a further consultation, given the situation we're in now, has any value, or are you saying that that consultation would be a sham?
Well, we have said publicly that we will not take part in the second round of public consultation because we think it will be a waste of time with the current framework. That's why we have suggested that the SAR government should submit another report to Beijing, or Beijing can ask the SAR government to submit a report telling them what is going on right now, because, as you all agree, things have changed quite drastically since the NPC-SC decision on the 31st of August. So they should submit another report saying things have changed, there are all these demands, and I hope the likes of Regina Yip and others will agree, will not seek to block democratic reforms. So if they also support it, and urge Beijing to reopen the whole discussion. I think this is the way forward. We don't want to fight, we don't want violence, and I'm glad that Regina said there will not be any bloody crackdown. And so the only way out is through dialogue. But as you all know, I speak as someone who's been banned from traveling to mainland China for more than 2 decades. Many members of my party have been banned. In the Legislative Council, where there are 70 members, at least 7 have been banned for more than 20 years. And this is the state of affairs. So I think that Beijing must understand that we need to have dialogue. And if CY Leung chooses not to come to LegCo on Thursday, and that would be a very, very bad sign.
Keith Bredge or New York Times. There have been some proposals that perhaps the demonstrators might go home and arrange to have another protest in a couple of weeks to see if the political ideas that they have advocated start to germinate. I have a question for each of you. Mrs. Ip, if that happened, would the government allow demonstrators to go home and give them some kind of safe passage if they went home now, or would it just simply go and arrest them, as some are concerned, the moment they walked in their front doors and were dispersed? And Ms. Lau, is there a tactical moment, either in the future or in the past, when you think it would make sense to interrupt the protests, or do the protests have to keep going even at the risk of antagonizing some members of the Hong Kong public until there's a final resolution?
Let me answer your question first. You know, I think the government and many of us, you know, the many citizens of Hong Kong would be more than happy for the demonstrators to go home and call it a day. It's been more than 2 weeks now. Very few demonstrators have actually been prosecuted, although they're actually engaging in unlawful assemblies. A small number of student leaders have been, you know, I think have been arrested and under investigation. If what you are asking is a promise from government to not to prosecute them as a condition for them to go home, I think that could be put to the government. But the question now is, who's leading the movement? Will the other demonstrators listen to Alex Chow or the other student leaders or Joshua Wong? You know, it looks like it has morphed into a leaderless and a highly fractious movement, you know. So that's the question, that's the problem.
Well, it is true that there is no one or two or three leaders of the movement. And as we all know, the people just pour onto the streets. I think it was on the 28th of last month when the police fired tear gas at the very peaceful demonstrators. At that time, I was actually locked up in the Wong Chuk Hang police station. We were locked up there for more than 10 hours. So the thing is, these people have come out of their own volition. They know it's civil disobedience. They are prepared to take the consequences. But they are also very peaceful and also pragmatic too. You saw the police action today, this morning. I don't know what's happening now. They were dismantling the blockade things that the students or the protesters put up, and nobody fought with the police. So I think the people are very peaceful, but some of them are very determined. A few days ago, some said, okay, we will leave Mong Kok, but then others fill their places. So there are different groups of people or individuals, but their demand is very united. They want universal suffrage. Of course, they want CY Leung to step down too. But some say universal suffrage is most important. Others say CY Leung. So two demands. So I think the way out is for the government to start talks with the student leaders, with the Occupy trio, with the legislators, with others, to show that they are willing to listen. And of course, we have to revisit the National People's Congress decision. Maybe Beijing will say no, but I hope the political and business elites in Hong Kong will come out and say, okay, it may be difficult for Beijing, but I think Beijing should listen. Instead of just acting as a parrot, keep saying, oh, Beijing will not listen, forget it, don't say it. I hope you will come out and say that, yes, this is something that Beijing should listen to and try to revisit the whole process. Because if Beijing wants it, they can reverse their decision like they did in 2010 when my party proposed an amendment. At that time, we were not talking about universal suffrage. And then Beijing said, no way. Donald Zhang held a press conference here. Beijing held a press conference on the same day saying, no deal. We will just present the package to LegCo as is. We said, okay, if you don't accept it, we'll vote you down. Then what happened? A week later, LC Leung came out and said, oh, there's nothing wrong with the Democratic Party's amendment. And then people like Regina all have to make a U-turn, maybe very painful. But Beijing has done it. Not that I'm saying they will definitely do it again. But let us say what we genuinely believe in, rather than to say, oh, don't try, don't bother, because Beijing will not wear it. I mean, that's not the right attitude.
Thank you. We're heading into the final few minutes, so I want to squeeze another two or three questions in, so if everyone could keep it as brisk as possible.
This is a question for both speakers. Both of you have been democratically elected by the Hong Kong people. Fact.
Yes.
The president of the European Union is not democratically elected, yet 70% of rules and regulations impacting on England are made by unelected people in the European Union. Most of the rules and regulations are for committees, small committees, who are not elected. So my question is this. Is it wrong to focus this debate about democracy upon the chief executive of Hong Kong? And would it be more beneficial to focus the debate on democracy as a system as a whole in Hong Kong? Because Hong Kong does seem to deliver peaceful protesters. If this was in England, protesters would be smashing things, breaking things up and destroying things. Both of you, certainly Emily has said that peaceful protest is a part of Hong Kong. Fantastic. But in democratic societies, that's not the case. So there's got to be something about the Hong Kong system that is working, that is not working in the European system.
Well,
that's a big question.
I think, you know, you are right that actually universal suffrage, which impinges on the extent of popular participation, is only one of the several dimensions of democracy. You know, I can talk at length on this subject, you know, but to cut a long story short, it's only one of the many aspects of democracy. A successful democracy also needs a government with the capacity to govern, and strong rule of law, protection of rights and liberties, and freedoms are alive and well in Hong Kong. Which government can allow an 8-lane carriageway to be blocked for 2 weeks without taking tough enforcement action? But when talking about democracy, we also need to focus not just on universal suffrage, the right to vote, the extent of public participation, but on the other important dimensions like democratic culture, capacity for governance, electoral systems and all that, which cannot be resolved by just street demonstrations.
I think that it is all very well to point to many democratic countries and point to the problems that they face. And I think in Hong Kong we are happy that we do enjoy freedoms and we have the rule of law. But as Regina said, freedom is alive and well. And if you ask the journalists over there, they will tell you it's not that well. Many of them are under tremendous pressure. Either self-censorship or even more brutal things, such as withdrawing advertisement, hitting your pocketbook, slashing up journalists, and so on. Or now Apple Daily being surrounded by protesters who even refuse to accept the injunction that the court has given. So, I mean, do we still have rule of law? I hope so. We are sort of just hanging in there. So it's all very well, you know, to compare with other places. But I think if you talk about the democratic system, one element is crucial. It's one person, one vote. You can say a place that has one person, one vote may not have democracy, like Singapore and other places. But if a place does not have one person, one vote, then definitely it's not democracy. So we have other trappings, and we are happy partly because of the British legacy and partly because of the people's vigilance all these years in safeguarding the rule of law and our rights. So, my dear friend, we have come to the crunch. And this time, Beijing has promised us. That's why some people were in tears on the 31st of August when Beijing made this decision. Why? Because they trusted Beijing. When Beijing said, okay, after my party supported the political reform in 2010, enabling the election in 2012 to go forward, Beijing said, yes, you have satisfied the requirement in the basic law, gradual and orderly progress. So, in 2017, you can elect the chief executive by universal suffrage. And after that, all of LegCo can be elected that way too. Beijing has not kept its promise. So how do you expect us to go forward without talking about this crucial thing?
Thank you. Lydia.
Sorry. Jan Lino from the Australian Consulate. I have a question that's principally for Mrs. Ip, but I would also be interested in Ms. Lau's views on this. You mentioned in your presentation in answer to other questions some of the issues that have not been prescribed under the NPC-SC decision. And Jasper Jang, I noticed, published a couple of days ago a whole sort of proposal for how a more democratic choice might be made available under the existing decision. Why is it that the government is not, in your view, taking this more actively out to the people to sort of entice them into this dialogue about the and to the pro-democratic legislators to have more of a sort of active discussion on, well, this is not the end of the story. There are other things that can be negotiated. Nobody seems to be talking about post-2017. So I'm wondering why that is not being more actively pursued.
That's a very good question. Yeah. Somehow I've talked to some students and they seem to be totally unaware of the legislative timetable, the legislative process, the details that need to be discussed. I've offered to discuss with them. I've also offered to brief, you know, talk with Emily's party members when they are ready, you know. So I think a lot more explanation needs to be done, but the fact is the NPC decision, the explanatory notes, actually says how the sectors are to be delimited, which organizations have the votes, and how many votes as for us to discuss in the next stage. I really urge the students and other demonstrators to, you know, talk to us, and I'm urging the government to talk to them.
I think that's a good question. Well, our feeling, our position is the framework laid down by the NPCSC cannot provide for democratic elections. But if they think that it can, and my definition of democratic election is that it will not contain any unreasonable limitations and can give the voters genuine choice. So within the framework of the nominating committee, if they want to democratize it, they should expand the franchise. Of course, to the ultimate is let everybody have a vote to choose the members of the nominating committee. But even if they do not stretch it to that limit, they must expand it from the current 250,000 to a lot more. And also the nominating threshold, which is already decided by the NPC, set in concrete, is 51%. And there is no way. How can you have a 51% nominating threshold and say that, oh, it can produce a democratic election? And also the limit, the ceiling, on 2 to 3 candidates. What miracle can you work? What rabbit can you pick out of the hat? But okay, if you try to engage and use that framework, see if you can work out something that people will say, any reasonable person, not necessarily lawyer, but lawyers included, say, ah, this process can produce an electoral method which will not contain unreasonable limitations and can give voters genuine choice. If that's the case, we're willing to discuss it.
I think 2 to 3 candidates mean only ultimately 2 to 3 nominations, but there's no limit on the numbers who can seek nominations. Just like primaries, you know, 10 people from each party can enter the race ultimately. One from each party or camp is nominated, you know.
Thank you. We are actually out of time, but I'm just going to squeeze one final question in from Francis, if we could just keep it as brief as possible, please.
Yeah, Francis Moriarty, freelance. This has been a tumultuous event, to say the least, for Hong Kong. And I'm wondering what you think the effect has been so far on Hong Kong's sense of itself and what you think the longer-term implications are for Hong Kong and its governance.
Me first? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It's for both of you. Thank you. Whoever wants to go first.
I think people from both camps have been saying Hong Kong will not be the same after these unprecedented protests, you know. But the jury is still out on how Hong Kong, what's next for Hong Kong, you know. Are we upsetting China so much that we are on the road to one country, one system ultimately? Or will we be able to hold firm one country, two systems? No doubt one country, two systems is being tested. But I think our government should be able to manage to resolve the current crisis within the remit of one country, two systems.
Well, there is no doubt the community is very split. There are rows in families, among friends. Some have been unfriended. And amongst students, I don't want to see a Hong Kong asunder. We used to be a united, happy community. And actually, I don't think the views of the Hong Kong people are that different, maybe apart from some political and business elites, because the vast majority of us would like to have democracy and to continue to enjoy our freedoms under the rule of law and a very independent judiciary, and to have clean government, no more people like Raphael Hui or Timothy Tong or Donald Zhang. So there is a way of healing this rift, and the ball is in Beijing's court. I hope Regina and her allies will tell Beijing what is the correct way out. And I'm very pleased to hear her telling you all that there will be no bloody crackdown, because I don't think the Hong Kong people or the world will allow it.
Thank you very much. Apologies to those of you who didn't weren't able to get your question in. There was a lot of people wanting to speak, and that's testimony, I think, to the force of argument that's been on show here, and the food for thought that will this city and us in the media community will be chewing over for a long time to come. Thank you very much, Regina Ip, Emily Lau, for an extremely stimulating discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank